She stoops quickly and, without breaking stride, picks the penny from the road and tucks it into the small inside pocket of her running shorts. That made 3 in as many miles. Out of the blue, she remembers finding 5 all in a row and perfectly spaced in a dirt parking lot at a beach on Newcastle Island. Last summer. No, the summer before. Before she met Peter. She'd thought about them for the rest of her rain-soaked run, and when she returned to the apartment over the donut shop, she placed them together along the sill of the bay window in the approximate configuration she'd found them, or as close as she could remember. GM had done that, put pennies in the corners of all her windows. Told Jamie it brought luck, old harpy that she was. She'd like to call herself that, old harpy. Jamie never knew why. She picks up her pace for the final mile, wiping the sweat from her forehead and eyes with a sticky forearm. It's still summer, third week of September or not, and the leaves of the oak trees lining this picture-perfect approach to town stubbornly refuse to fade. Irritated by all the perfection, the rich green lawns, the long row of quaint weathered salt boxes, she pushes harder, smiling only when the familiar warning pains begin in her legs. And pushes harder, concentrating on the pain now, on finishing the run and dropping the pennies into the smoky glass jar she began using once she'd crammed all the windowsills to capacity. She was still living over the donut shop the first time the jar itself became full, she remembers now. She'd taken it downstairs, bought herself coffee and a muffin, and sat outside at one of the tables set along the sidewalk. The cool breeze from the harbor pushing off the heat while she watched the cars weave in and out of the small traffic circle feeding the marina. The trip downstairs clutching the jar of found money had a ceremonial feel that appealed to her, and she repeated it now each time the jar filled with coins, an oddly soothing ritual born of the running that had saved her life. For a long time after the accident, she'd concentrated solely on this filling of windowsills. Money found as she built herself up again. At first they'd said she'd walk with a limp. Special shoes and various cane options were discussed. Then, when she'd proven them wrong about that, they'd warned her against running. To try, they'd reasoned, would be to risk all the progress she'd made. Now, 3 years later, she was back to running 5 miles a day, 4 or 5 days a week, pushing herself, like today, to the point of pain. It gave her something to focus on, the rhythm of her feet hitting the ground, filling her ears, emptying her mind, while the windowsills filled with coins. GM had been wrong about the luck part, as it turned out, but she kept picking the change up anyway. Her legs scream for relief, but she ignores them and thinks again of the cool, impassive faces of the doctors, the nurses who'd known too much to be comfortable in her presence. She remembers little else about the hospital. That whole first year had the feel of a vivid dream gone hazy and unreal upon waking, with just little bits coming back to her over time. She has only a dim recollection of moving into the apartment above the donut shop the summer following the accident, coming to herself finally, it seemed, amid the rich, yeasty smells that wafted up to her each morning before dawn. But always there was the running, the connection to her body immediate and reassuring. All this before she'd met Peter and had gone to live with him on the boat, before they'd been married, his agreeing, reluctantly, never to try for kids. She rounds the final corner, skirting the edge of the traffic circle as she takes in the familiar sight of masts bobbing in the harbor, the keening of the gulls. Passing the donut shop perched at the circle's edge, someone else living in the apartment above it now, she slows as she reaches the wharf and the string of shacks hawking everything from rod and reel rentals to whale watch and sport fishing trips, walking its length and back while she cools off, hands on hips, breathing hard, the front of her t-shirt soaked in a sweaty half-moon slung between her breasts. The dogs pace anxiously in the cockpit while she stretches on the warm planking of the dock, Lucille wriggling her little sausage body in anticipation, Gus offering a wide, disinterested yawn from beneath a furry Airedale mustache. "Hey, kids," she says, climbing aboard. "Yes, okay, okay. Stop the licking. Ugh, Peter, call the dogs."
"Yo!"
His voice booms from somewhere below deck, and Gus and Lucille are gone in an instant, scrambling down the companionway in a clattering of nails. Jamie, lazy in a runner's soporific afterglow, sits for a minute fingering the coins in the pocket of her shorts. The constant small movements of the boat at first made it hard to find places where the sill pennies might sit. But Peter had solved the problem with pieces of double-sided tape, and now the lower edges of all the port lights winked with a coppery gleam. GM would be pleased, she thinks. She goes below and empties the shorts at the galley sink, dropping the pennies in the running jar wedged above the stove between two of Peter's cookbooks, and rinses cool water through the sweaty, worn baby socks she keeps tucked at the bottom of the pocket. Peter's back is to her, his close-cropped head of sandy hair bent over a laptop. The aquaculture project at the Isles of Shoals, no doubt. "Laurie and Bake for dinner tonight, babe," he says, turning. The smile is tentative, apologetic. "Okay by you?" Jamie shrugs, squeezing the little green sock and letting the water pool in her hand again. He pulls himself up from the desk he's built into the bulkhead opposite the galley and comes to stand behind her, encircling her waist with his arms, nuzzling her neck. "What are you doing?" she complains. "Just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in," he sings softly. Jamie smiles into the sink as she squeezes the sock. "Kenny Rogers in the first edition," she says after some thought. He nods into her neck, planting kisses, "before he got into country." She thinks for a minute, letting the music take hold in her mind. Then, traveling the arpeggio of triplets, the melody's turns and syncopated tempo of three against four, she hums the largo section of the Fantaisie Impromptu. "Bach? Chopin," she corrects. "Damn," he says, rocking her gently now. "So it's okay tonight, Laurie and Bake?" She glances toward his collection of cookbooks. Miami Spice, Biker Billy Cooks with Fire, Eat This, the ubiquitous shrimp. "Nothing too spicy," she reminds him. "Laurie won't eat it." "I'll do something Thai but mild. Chili's on the side for those who want to go nuts." He hesitates, nuzzles her again. "Feeling punky?" She turns and puts her arms around him, the little sock a sodden ball in her fist. "Better now." "Yeah, well, before you start feeling too good, there's a letter from Philippe. I left it for you on the table." It isn't until she goes to shower off under a generous steam of warm water, a letter still unopened, that she begins to shake. She'd almost made it, too. "He'll be 5 tomorrow," she tells herself for the 1,000th time since breakfast. "Would have been," she amends. "Would have been." This part even Peter doesn't know. The sun is almost down, and still they linger in the cockpit, the growing chill settling into shimmering translucent beads on the fiberglass combing. Before long, they'll be spending all their evenings below deck, layered in sweaters and listening to the hiss of the coal stove, and Jamie isn't yet ready to give up sitting beneath a night sky full with moon and blinking with stars. She leans her head back against the warmth of Peter's arm and looks skyward, beyond the broad swath of the Milky Way, to the stars of the Pleiades and the hunter Orion, horny son of the god Neptune, who, according to Peter, had a thing for unwilling virgins. She traces the belt, sword, and legs of his constellation, then glances to the west, where the deteriorating hulk of the old Wentworth Hotel looms from atop a far hill. "It's the rudeness that gets you." Bake, on the opposite bench beside Laurie, scratches the chin, buried somewhere in his full dark beard. "They hired another spare last week. Little old lady. Trained her myself. So get this. Last night she's in the toll booth next to mine, taking some guy's money, right? She looks down to thank him, being a retired school teacher and polite and all, and the freak's sitting there jerking off, watching her reaction. She's a grandmother, for Christ's sake. Beaky nose, those long, dangly hairs under the chin. I mean, explain the appeal." "You gotta get out of there," Peter tells him. "Road rage is endemic, my friend. Toll takers are an obvious target." "Toll attendant, please. And you're working the graveyard shift, all those sickos passing through just looking for someone to set them off? Evidence you're flasher." "He ain't my anything, Pete," Bake warns. "I could use you on the fish farming project. The White Island mussels start coming in next month. Pretty good pay, too, courtesy of Noah. And you're the best systems man I've ever seen. Pure genius when it comes to changing out an engine. There's enough work in this harbor alone to keep you busy. More than enough." "Not in the winter, pal. And with Laurie still looking. I want something different this time, Laurie announces, as though changing jobs was akin to picking out a new dress. Something interesting, like Jamie's job. Development director for a symphony orchestra. Wow, I'm like in awe. Jamie recoils from the comment. She hasn't learned to read Laurie yet, but the sucking up is getting old. The girl acting when they'd first met, as if she'd never come across markedly patrician features on a woman before, or a tallish, lanky build matched with golden, almost tawny coloring, calling her green eyes haunting or haunted, something like that. Jamie can't decide if she's extremely young or just being shrewd, covering all the bases since her relationship with Bake is so new. It's not as glamorous as it sounds, Jamie corrects. I spend my time trying to talk people into giving money to the arts. It's tiring, not to mention extremely frustrating. Don't let her kid you, Peter says. She's more than tripled corporate support in the 2 years she's been here. The orchestra she was with in New York tried everything to keep her when she quit. Huge raise, bonus, you name it. This is veering dangerously toward a discussion as to why she'd moved to New Hampshire to take a job paying less than half what she was making in New York. So Jamie does what only moments before would have been unthinkable. The new season starts in a few weeks, Laurie. They've been looking for someone for the box office. I could find out where they are on it, if you like. Wow, I mean, yeah, that'd be great. Peter turns a sly smile on Jamie. He's been baiting Laurie all evening, but gently, and wouldn't do it at all, Jamie knew, if he thought Bake was serious about her. Never mind she's already living in the house trailer out in Lee. That doesn't necessarily mean anything with Bake. Jamie considers the two of them, deciding the age difference has to be considerable. Bake, she knows, is 33, like Peter. His real name, Nikolai, is far more in keeping with his hairy lumberjack appearance, but he never uses it except when he reaches them on the cell with the inevitable greeting, "It is I, Nikolai." She's never been told his last name. It seems extraneous with someone like Bake, who, Peter once told her, was a professional hockey player in Canada until he bit some guy's earlobe off. Laurie, with her chin-length auburn hair, long dark bangs, and doe eyes, is probably all of 25 and right now is desperately trying to fit in. "How far do you have to drive?" she asks, her gaze shifting from Peter to Jamie. "I don't have a really good car." "Nashua, about an hour," Peter says. "But you can ride with Jamie, right, Jay?" Jamie ignores him. "Let's start by finding out about the job, okay? It could be filled now, for all I know." "Anyway," Peter says, unwilling to let the subject drop, "there's some big arts conference in New York next month, their way of enticing her back only for a few days. All the bigwigs flying in from around the country to hear Ms. Jamie Lloyd reveal her secrets, teach them how to talk multinational corporations into forking their profits over for the cultural benefit of mankind. Stuff like that." Bake stifles a yawn with a pull on his old Molson. "You going then?" Jamie shrugs. "Thinking about it," she turns to Laurie. "Peter's putting you on. It's the annual American Symphony Orchestra League Conference. It just happens to be in New York this year, and it has nothing to do with me, really. I'm not even sure I'm going." "Oh, she'll go," Peter says as the dogs begin barking from their customary after-dinner perch in the bow. "You couldn't keep her away." He turns to wave to a couple walking arm in arm toward the Morgan 38, bobbing gently in the next slip. Laurie whispers something to Bake, who rolls his eyes. "Come on, Laure. It's not a bathroom, it's a head. We went all over this, remember?" "I'd just get mixed up, is all." Jamie feels a reluctant stab of sympathy for the girl, tossed as roughly into the world of boating lingo as she herself had been. The first time Peter took her sailing, she remembers now, he informed her there was no kitchen on a boat but a galley. No bathroom but a head. No front and back to a vessel, he'd said, by then enjoying her considerable confusion, but bow and stern. Left was port, right starboard. His bedroom, which she gained intimate knowledge of that weekend, was the forepeak. It had no bed but a bunk. She imagines it's something like moving to a foreign country, strange language and customs, traditions so old no one could remember when they started or why. It took her months to get it all straight. And Laurie, it's obvious, is simply no match for these two. "Come on," Jamie says, putting her club soda on the bench beside her. "I'll take you down." She's reading in the bunk when Peter finally flips off the desk light and comes to her, stretching out fully clothed to rest his head in her lap. He cranes his neck to peer at the title of the article she's been skimming. 10 deadly mistakes in direct mail campaigns, he recites. Sexy stuff. A sheepish grin. She's such a dim bulb, Jay, I couldn't help it. I know, Jamie says, turning the page, but we can't all be PhDs in marine biology, and Bake seems to like her. Yeah. She can tell by his tone he stopped listening. Doctor, doctor, give me the news, he sings, sliding his hand along her thigh. I've got a bad case of loving you. She puts the article down. Robert, somebody, you've done this one before, you know. You're starting to repeat yourself. Robert Palmer, he informs her, reaching above her head to shut off the reading light. No pills gonna cure my ills. I got a bad case of loving you. And then he begins. They're lovemaking long and slow tonight, the papers slipping to the floor as she loses herself in the welcome oblivion of it, curling hard into him as he eases her gently past the midnight hour and into the first of the 2 days she's come to dread each year. The other 363, she simply marks time, the hours ticking off toward their inevitable return.